I just found this amazing drawing in my hymnal that says whirlwind, and it's a picture of a bird.
Wow.
So be careful what happens when you open the hymnal. My name is Margie, and I serve the village helping out with teaching staff. And we have a wonderful session today with Matthew Olson, who has been to Holden many times and is up here this week as village musician, as I'm sure you saw last night at Eucharist. But he has agreed to lead a couple sessions as well, and so he's going to take us through the journey of Bach and Luther and singing, and so get excited. Just so you know, this session is being recorded, so keep that in mind as you sing or ask questions, or both. Okay. Yay, Matthew!
Margie, now no one will sing when we know that we all have to sing. Good afternoon, and thanks for being here today. I hope your day was a wonderful one thus far. We're going to spend a little bit of time this afternoon looking at Martin Luther, both the social reformation and also the theological underpinnings of the Reformation. How he used music as a vessel and a vehicle to really enable and live out those values. How J.S. Bach picked up on those and learned from that and brought that into music. And then lastly, how that has connected into our singing tradition today, or perhaps not. We'll have a chance for some singing, a chance for some discussion, and I'll share some things too. So today's questions we're going to look at, firstly, is why did Martin Luther write hymns? Many of you know he wrote an incredible amount of hymn texts, but also hymn tunes also. Perhaps his most famous, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God.
Borrowed tunes.
What's that?
Borrowed tunes.
And some borrowed tunes. Yes, absolutely. Secondly, how did the ideals of Luther's Reformation influence hymnody and church music, both in his time and today? Third, who was J.S. Bach in short? Many of you know who J.S. Bach was. We'll do a brief overview as to why it matters in today's discussion. Next, how did Reformation theology influence the music of J.S. Bach and some of his contemporaries at the time? And lastly, where does that leave us today in the brief overview of things from 1750, really until the present? How have things changed? What values have stayed consistent? I thought it might be a great way for us to start by taking out our hymnals, speaking of A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and let's just sing through this today to set us together. We'll try singing, there's two different rhythms, as most of you know, to this tune. We'll sing the older one. As most of us know, Luther was a Roman Catholic monk. seeking changes initially within the church. He was very, very vocal about that, especially in his early writings. He had no intentions to start a new church when he first started being so vocal about changes. And there were at least four things that he wrote a lot about from my brief knowledge. He believed in a God of all people. A faith practice and forgiveness of sin should not be dictated by wealth or social class. And that was something, of course, as we know, that was very different and butting a lot of heads with the Catholic Church. He believed that God is almighty, not the Pope and the church executives at the time. Mm-hmm. Believed that church that serves God by serving all of God's people. And lastly, that he believed that church and state should be separate powers, which I always find interesting if that dialogue continues in modern history today. Really, a beginning of a step towards what we know now as a democratic republic. So from these things, we know of his primary three foundations of his theology, the sola scriptura, the sola gratia, and the sola fide, or scripture alone, grace alone, faith alone. This matters so much in our discussion about Bach's music and Luther's hymnody writing, because these things are absolutely elemental into all the musical decisions that you'll find Bach made. Every note had purpose. Every one of those purposes derived back to these three elements or pillars of Luther's theology. So the bottom line here is that the Reform really disempowered the church, believing instead that one's relationship with God lay in their own hands. Most importantly, the justification of faith, but that salvation through faith alone. So Luther in music, he believed that two elements were absolutely essential to worship, especially in regards to music. The first being that worship should serve to educate people, and that simply worship should serve to praise God. Those two things, which seem perhaps elementary when you think about it, and yet at the time, church was not serving to educate people. In fact, as we know, there was a very small minority of people who were fluent enough to read Latin or to understand Latin, and yet Mass was entirely in Latin. So automatically an enormous social barrier and education barrier. Secondly, giving praise and thanks to God, one might argue that was not always the central pillar of the Roman Catholic Church at that time. And so he was dedicated to changing these two things. He saw music as the perfect vessel for this. So a few really important things that we give thanks to Luther for. He changed hymns and much liturgy to the German vernacular at the time, so that everyone, whether they were literate or not in German or in Latin, would have a chance to understand the gospel, to sing together, to pray together, to hear the preaching. He saw that Latin as being elite and exclusive, whereas German for the people was a church for the people and a worship. Secondly, he wrote hymn texts that taught the Reformation theology. We'll dig into those a little bit, briefly, but he really thought that music was a way to connect with people differently, people that might not be as moved through the preacher's words, but might really understand sung word in a different or deeper way. And lastly, he wrote hymn tunes that serve to praise and adore God, connecting with that second element essential to worship. There's so many quotes from Luther on music, but here are a few of my favorites. Next to theology itself, music is the highest art, the education and praising of God. We see those two elements we just mentioned right there. Secondly, music is the greatest gift of God, which has often induced and inspired me to preach. So how did Luther teach and praise through hymnody? Sunday Vespers, he wrote hymn settings each part of the catechism. So here was a step that was extremely diligent, saying, how do we bring these words and these new teachings, these reforms, right into song, a song that can be understood and practiced for the people. So we have these from the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, repentance, any one of these things. Secondly, his hymn form embraced his own theology. Now, this we'll talk later about. This is maybe one of the biggest differences between what we might call Lutheran hymnody of this time versus the Christian popular music that's really common today. So what we have here is very common, a confession of sin, a plea for mercy, the deliverance of the good news, and then the adoration and praise of that good news. Remember this, because Bach took this directly and used it in every one of his 200 plus cantatas. That same exact structure. And so often, Luther, and certainly Bach as well, was trying to bring the dialogue of law versus gospel to life in song. So we have Martin Luther's words here: what is law does not make progress, but what is gospel does. The gospel is the same as the improvisation and spirit shared by singers and performers. The written pitches are merely the law. He saw music as a living experience of the gospel emerging from the law. The transition, just like so many fantastic preachers see their role, as the opportunity to bring the law to life through the news. A transition between the old book and the new book. So I wanted to spend a few minutes together here looking at one of Luther's hymn texts. Unfortunately, this is one of the many hymn tunes that has been cut out of the ELW since the LVW, a lot of those old German standards. However, I thought we could see a little bit of the structure that he helped design that Bach utilized also. So if we just read together, I won't read this verbatim, but we can see on the left side is the text of this hymn, and the right side are the four main areas, in the six different areas theologically that embrace that. So initially we see the presentation of the conflict. Some might argue that is the presentation of the law. The ominous challenge in which the good news must overcome. We see then the confession of sins. We mourn our grievous sins. Sometimes it's really blatant, just like that. Other times the language is not quite as direct, but you see a grievance somehow. In this text, we also see a fear of the law, which isn't always in place in Luther's text, but he did believe deeply in some elements of fear. And then we see, after the confession of sin, we see an element of plea for mercy. And just in case he missed it, the law returns. Save us, Lord, from sinking in the deep and bitter flood. Lord, have mercy. So at this point, we're hoping for some good news. And sure enough, the second half of the hymn delivers the gospel. Thou only, Lord, canst do it. It moves thy tender heart. We see compassion. We see a faith. And then we see our great sin and misery is removed. We see the justification through faith. And this mercy, the same text that was used as the application of mercy, becomes the explanation of the good news. This was absolutely essential to Bach's music also. Applicatio, explicatio. And lastly, the praise. Thou eternal God, let not hell dismay. A small reminder of the law, just in case you've forgotten, just kind of always pinching you a little bit. But then, with this deep and burning flood, Kyrie eleison. So that being said, our brief overview of Luther and why it matters. What do we as a community here know about J.S. Bach?
Yes, he was a church musician.
He was a church musician.
Played on Sunday.
Yep, played on Sunday, absolutely. What else do we know?
Composed many, many arias, cantatas, and so forth for the music that he played, and was always looking for more money.
Yes,
that bunch of children, he had real trouble with his budget.
He wanted to write for the opera. He wanted to be an opera writer, didn't he?
Yeah, he had an incredible flair for the dramatic. And opera was not something that was alive and well in Germany at that time, but he was very aware of it from trips to Italy. Composers like Vivaldi and people that were before Vivaldi. So we only have a chance to even that too much, but we see a lot of the elements of the cutting edge dramatic music of the time brought into both his sacred and secular music. It's one of the things that Handel, like the Messiah, and Bach's music is known so much for, is that the energy and the continued fruition of the drama unfolding through music.
Chorale preludes for every part of the church year.
Yes, he wrote chorale preludes for the organ and harpsichord, for every, it's tremendous. Yeah, for every season and hymn out there. He had improvised and then written down the improvisation of the hymns. Yes.
And he, his music was not universally accepted in his time. There was great controversy over his being too wise.
Yes, this is a really interesting point. His music was seen as a little bit too, we'll say musically flamboyant at the time. He was such a genius with improvisation that a lot of his head boss pastors would have to say, whoa, let's tame that down a little bit. Which is interesting because his sons thought he was so old and boring. His sons, who were also composers, thought he was old news. Super boring, and they moved on from very quickly. But yes, he struggled with that at certain times. And was a really savvy businessman. Always wanted more money. Had 21 children, of which 11 survived past childhood. Yeah, 21 children, but two different wives. One died. Yes, the women in the room all got very large eyes. No, not in childbirth, but yeah, he had two different wives. One of my other favorite facts, in case there's any wine lovers in the room, I love wine, and one of my favorite facts about Bach in regards to his finances too, for his second wedding, he spent the equivalent of an annual salary. He made roughly $65,000 a year in Leipzig, and he spent an entire year's salary on 5 custom-made wine barrels from Italy for his wedding. Isn't that, we spend a lot of money on weddings these days, but can you imagine spending your entire annual salary for
she
one?
She was worth it.
Yeah, you gotta hope, right? You gotta hope. Okay, anything else we want to share about what we know about J.S. Bach? Okay, we'll cover a few things that we didn't mention then. So Bach grew up in a central part of Germany, which coincidentally was the same small region in which Luther and the Reformation happened. Imagine being able to go to Stehekin from here and being able to be at the center of the Reformation. That's how close he was to that. So he was very much influenced by Luther's philosophy. He grew up in a family of church musicians that were through like 4 generations of Lutheran and Protestants. And his schooling and education was very much embraced, not just in Latin and mathematics and science, but also every day in Lutheran theology. So he was an absolute expert, as was expected of church musicians of that time. So after many moves from smaller towns to medium-sized towns, he was a savvy businessman and was very determined to work his way up the ranks in his region of Germany. And he eventually got to Leipzig. And Leipzig was maybe not the regional center for really great music, but it certainly was a regional center for the university and for theology. So a lot of the leading professors of Lutheran and Reformation theology were based in Leipzig at this time. And one really interesting component, just to highlight the depth of theological knowledge he had to have, part of his audition and interview process required a written exam of 4 hours on the Book of Concord. Because his job, in addition to overseeing music at 4 churches, in addition to teaching all of the boys that went to the school, he taught daily classes in theology, Bible study, and confirmation. As a church musician, I can't imagine having to do that all day. You know, the breadth of your knowledge base must have been tremendous. And so through all this training, most importantly, his philosophy, he saw music and worship as another lens through which to experience the gospel. And as he started writing more and more music for the church, as he did in Leipzig, to a prolific extent, he saw that as his sermon. In the same way the preacher saw his job, or her job at the time, his job, to know the gospel so well, to bring to life in a way that might help people experience that through a new lens. So one of the things that perhaps exemplifies his prolific writing best is his cantata writing, which some of you mentioned. Starting his first year in Leipzig, 1723, he started writing a different cantata every Sunday and for all festival days, every year. Now, most of us can't comprehend this. The cantata, for those of us that aren't terribly familiar, is like it's like a mini oratorio. So it's a 6 or 7 movement work for orchestra, soloists, and choir. It includes arias, sinfonias, recitatives, chorales, and extremely virtuosic choruses. Average one probably around 25 minutes in length. And to put that in perspective, if you were to hire a composer today, like John Adams, to write your church a 25-minute new work, he would tell you, I might be able to get it done in 3 years, and it will cost you $100,000. Bach did one of these every week, and every day of Christmas. 12 days of Christmas, he had a new one every day. It's just really hard to understand. However, we do know now why perhaps he had so many children. They were his factory in the basement. They were trained to notate. And so his kiddos, he would write the master's score, and one of their jobs every day was to help him by lifting the violin part into a separate part, or the chorus part. And so that was part of the reason that all the Bach families in Germany had a lot of kids. It was survival, you know? So each one of these cantatas, the text was based on the assigned readings of the day, the epistle reading and also the gospel reading. And one thing Bach did in the tradition of working with the vernacular and connecting the people to worship is that he very intentionally used beloved hymn tunes that everyone in worship would have known at the time, and he incorporated that oftentimes into every movement of the entire cantata. Now, the congregation wouldn't have been singing along, but they would know this in the same way as if you hear some of Aaron Copland's music, you might hear an old Western folk tune. And that would bring you deeper into the music. It would connect you and make it more accessible. Especially remember that he wrote a new work every Sunday, and many of his most famous works only got performed twice rather than once in his entire lifetime. Can you imagine writing a work like the St. Matthew Passion, 3 hours long, and in your entire lifespan, you get to do it twice? It's remarkable. So now he adopted structure similar to Luther's hymn writing, which is why we went through that before. His sacred cantata structure is often analogized to the same 4 steps. The statement of the problem presented by the law, the exploration of the implications of this challenge, an initial presentation of the gospel, it's kind of a hint at the good news, and then a rowdy celebration of the good news in case you missed it the first time. So what we're going to do is I'm going to talk less now, and we're going to get to listen a little bit more. And what we're going to do is we're going to go over a cantata. It's number 114. And I want you to have a chance just to hear how each one of those 4 stages is brought to life musically. So this is a cantata that was written for what was often the 2nd or 3rd week of September now. And so it was not a major feast day by any means, which means you won't hear brass or timpani in the orchestration. But what you will hear is an angst and a despair over the initial challenge of the law. Moment of truth to see if this works.
Thank you.
general spirit of that opening?
Pretty
energetic. Energetic, I heard. Yeah, rhythmically it's very energetic. What else?
Angst.
Yeah.
Your concern.
It's a deep concern. It's a deep, anxious concern.
I would say melodic.
Melodic. Yeah. Yes, and it's extremely melodic because we hear that hymn tune above always. And that's one of those things that Bach was known for. Incredible, brilliant improvisation around a tune everyone would have known. Now, after this initial statement, we get the kind of the implications of this problem. And here, the next movement is a stunning aria, a tenor aria. This by the group, all these excerpts of the group that I lead in Minneapolis. It's a group that's dedicated just to the sacred music of Bach. And this is a wonderful tenor and flautist performing together. Jesus. Of the gospel. This is the fourth of seven movements. And to Bach, so often the gospel came in the alto voice. He saw the alto voice as being the most motherly. He saw it often as Mary's voice to Jesus. So that was maternal instinct that he thought often, not always, but often brought the good news.
That's so deep.
Joy, absolutely.
It seems kind of solid and grounded.
Yeah.
Maybe just in the voice.
Yeah, whereas that previous movement we heard, it was almost impossible to hear a steady tempo. It was that free-form spirit, just kind of floating. All of a sudden, we hear that really grounded meter, and that bass kind of drives that home. While the vocal part is major in tone, tonality again, and it's really confident but joyful. Now, of all of Bach's years in Leipzig, the second year he decided to try to write a new cantata every Sunday. He decided to do something really consistently, and that's he ended each one of the cantatas with a full setting of the hymn that had permeated throughout the cantata. And it's argued occasionally, but most scholars agree now that this was actually, even though everyone would have known this chorale tune, the congregation was not singing along. Because, as we'll look later, they were rather complex. But everyone would have recognized this tune. This is the end. This is the emphatic endorsement of the gospel. And all the forces come back together for that final period. Because the more you sing and learn, the more depth you discover. This is one of the other best known Bach hymn settings. Unfortunately, it's one of those that's also gotten, I think it's been cut from the ELW. But many of you will know it, I suspect. It starts. Now, do you know this? Oh, yeah? Okay. So it just sings, "Break forth, O beauteous morning light, and fill the heaven with glory. Ye shepherds folk, restrain your fright, and hear the angel's story." Let's just try singing this a cappella together and see how we do. Two and three.
Break forth, O beauteous morning light, and
I'm
for most of us. But I picked it because it is the full version that Bach harmonized. He used this hymn in a few different places, but most famously in his Christmas oratorio, which is not so much an oratorio as it is six entire cantatas pieced together. Can you imagine going to church on Christmas Eve and hearing a three-hour work of music? Oof. It'd be a long sit. What we're going to do for just a few minutes, though, is look at how Bach is trying to bring together Luther's theology in musical nuance, in text painting, and embodiment. So the text, Brich an, o schönes Morgenlied, the English translation here is quite good. We hear it break forth, O beauteous morning light. And look what the tenor rhythm does, for those of us that read music, compared to the main soprano theme. What do we see happening? It starts to soar.
And it's in the first full measure, it's not like on the downbeat.
Yes. So everyone else is singing, break forth, O beauteous. And the tenors, as typical, have gone rogue. And they sing, break for or, oh, beauteous. It's syncopated. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no reason for Bach to do that. I mean, this hymn was around well before he was. There were many harmonizations that didn't do this. He very intentionally chose to change the tenor part, as if the tenor voice is literally breaking through. Mm-hmm. Now, you see my blue arrow, it's a bit hard to see in this light, but you'll see in the second full measure, the basses have an octave leap. So often, Bach will give the basses the role of bringing this theology to light. So we see, break forth, O beauteous morning light. And as the text says, morning light, descending from heaven, Bach often used spatial reasoning in that way. So the basses, for no reason, drop down an octave and then bring the light back up. And then, as we see right here, the text is fill the heavens with glory. And if we had time to compare this bass line compared to all of the other bass lines that had existed for this tune, they would all be quite stagnant. But here, Bach slowly ascends and leaps again vertically, a very large leap for most basses, with the highest pitch peaking agogically at the glory. This is really one of those things that the more you dig in, the more you hear it, and you feel it. As we go on, like Luther, Bach was so perplexed that in this Christian faith, the Savior came down to us as an infant. It's a vulnerable, frail infant. And the majority of times when Bach sets texts that address this, he uses some type of rhythmic motive that rocks and lilts as if a baby is in a mother's arms. This is one of those things that's easy to say, I bet that's not what he meant. But then as you look through the 1,056 known pieces we have in Bach's, it's every time. It's hard to argue against. So we see right here, Schwache Nebichlein, that is this little infant child, this vulnerable, tender infant. And we see a very gentle, subtle rocking happening in that first full measure. Now, again, the basses are given an important theological role. We start talking about the pearls of peace and grace. And you see that our comfort and joy will be, the basses all of a sudden start singing chromatically by steps. It causes a little tension, release, as the text talks about not yet the arrival of the comfort, but the seeking and waiting, the Sehnsucht. This last page is just, I couldn't stop. There were so many examples, I had to just pick four. Oftentimes, the basses are given the role of talking about the devil because of the low voice being associated with the evil. So we have the word fiend come in, the evil one, and the basses descend back down stepwise as we start to consider the role of the devil You'll see I added these crosses here. This is another one of those musical tools that Bach often utilized. Anytime he was talking about the theology of the cross, or mentioning the justification or salvation through faith alone, and the gift that was for all people, he created a cross pattern in the notation. So you can see it here, it alternates up and down twice. And you'll see it again, it's almost always at the end of every one of these chorales. You can look for it even in the ELW. One of the voices is given the role of outlining the cross at the final statement of the gospel or the good news. And here it's usually da, 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 da. Down, up, down, down. Okay? And that's, again, one of those things that some people are like, ugh, that's bogus. And then you look through the hundreds of times that he did this, every time the theology of the cross emerges. And lastly, one of his other really common tools he used, anytime he was talking about angels descending, or a gift from God descending, but the gift of grace, or the gift of peace, you'll see groupings of two notes descending very gently down. Now, counterjusting the bases when they descend, talking about das Fiend, or the evil one, the devil, there's never a lilt or a beauty in that. It's usually chromatic, it's usually quite abrasive. But here, the tenors are given that sweet voice, the same peace at last regained, and the gospel, after seven movements, is fully arrived. It's an incredible thing. It is an incredible thing. In the world right now, there are at least a handful of very famous conductors that are in their 80s that have dedicated their entire lives to just the music of Bach. And I think it speaks volumes about the depth of his music. And to me, there's no other composer whose faith was so, and theology was so thoroughly integrated into every note that he wrote. Which is especially remarkable when you consider how many notes he must have written in those 1,056 works that we have. We have 7 or 8 minutes left, and I wanted to talk together a little bit about where we've gone since Bach. As you look through the ELW, there's still an enormous amount of music that is from the originators of humanity from the Reformation and Bach's time period. But certainly there is at least another half or two-thirds of our modern Lutheran hymnal in the ELCA that is now dedicated to everything that has happened chronologically since. So let's talk a little bit, let's brainstorm. What musically happened hymn-wise? What can you think about from 1750 to 1900? Do you ever pay, like when you're bored in church, you ever look down to see when that hymn was written? Yeah?
That's never happened.
This never happened before? Yeah. So can you think of, do you often see text or composers listed from that time frame?
Yeah. Like all our American hymns.
Yes. So this is like the Southern, some people call it a Southern harmony tradition. Scholars in this field, of course, have heated debates about the slave plantation songs that were written when slaves went to church with the white masters and sang afterwards. They were allowed to sing together. So who wrote a lot of those hymns, we don't know for sure. But that is one of the most beautiful and unique contributions to humanity that we have. Some of the Appalachian folk songs, some of the Irish folk songs, and then all those Southern harmony tunes, a lot of which we know and are super dear to us. That is America's big contribution to humanity. Western Europe was really abnormally quiet during this time period. The Germans kind of hung on to everyone else and just kind of kept it going. Bach wasn't well known outside of the church, but all of his music from Leipzig was still used at Leipzig. That's an awful misconception. Mendelssohn helped bring it to the concert hall, but Bach's music didn't die. It was just regional, central Germany. What about 1900 and 1950?
Is
that where you get that sort of pious poetry stuff?
Yes.
It's almost hard to say. I mean, hard to... It's a little overdone.
Yes, it's really laborious, high-educated, pious poetry. Hmm. And a lot of that came from what we call the Second New England School of Music. Kind of the post-Billings stuff, some of you know Billings. That came, and a lot of the text was really heavy. And a lot of the hymn tunes were terribly singable, but some of them certainly remained. And what do we think about what's happened chronologically 1950 to present in our hymn tunes? Yes?
And back to period instruments.
Yes.
We did on the West Coast anyway.
Yes. So a big shift has happened in America following Europeans back to period instruments. Playing instruments that were the same style and design from the time it was used in Bach's time.
And smaller choirs.
Smaller choirs. What happened in the hymnal? What hymns do you think about 1950s, 60s, 70s? Or what music was alive and well in the church in the 60s and 70s?
Well, you had some things like the African-American hymn.
Yes.
Lifting your voice and singing, I'm just trying.
Yes.
Thomas Dorsey, Precious Lord.
Precious Lord, take my hand. So there's a deeper infiltration of the history of African American, a Methodist black church music came into hymnals. What else?
More global representation.
Yes, the global report started in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And that's something that's really now come standardized in the ELW, much more so when we compare it to the LDW. What else?
In some cases new hymns, but in some cases revising of hymns to be gender inclusive or more gender inclusive.
Absolutely. One of the big elements of work was done to publish the ELW was making that shift. And all you have to do is open a different denomination, Lutheran denomination hymnal, to see what changes we made in the ELCA versus other denominations. I grew up in a church full of post-1960s folk and bluegrass hippies, like my parents. So I grew up with songs like Will the Circle Be Unbroken or I'll Fly Away. And that really became common in churches across the country. That old songs book, you remember that one? It had a lot of the Americana folk that was either sacred or kind of pseudo-sacred. And then most recently here we're kind of in home, one of Marty Haugen's homes, right? And so we can recognize how many hymns does Marty Haugen have in the ELW? 20? 30? Wow. Yeah.
Did they put the harmonizations back in? I mean, I know that at one time they took out all the Bach harmonizations and then they put it back in.
Yeah, it's kind of
there's
a mixture.
A lot's
been taken out because we got complaints about the size and the weight of the book being too large. I was on a committee and that's one of the biggest complaints we got was Arthur Decan were having a hard time as we added so many more pages. And so one thing they didn't cut out Bach's harmonizations, they just didn't print them in the handheld version.
Oh.
They're printed in the big organ editions, or the piano editions. Yeah.
Are the Canadians still using their little crummy poetry book instead of a hymnal? Do you know?
I don't know. Anyone here Canadian?
That's all I ever saw up there. Was
the Anglican Church.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. We're Anglicans.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yep. Well, yes, Kate.
I'm struck by how prolific Bach was, of course, but I'm also struck by the fact that he had musicians that could sing this.
Yes. Yes, incredible, right? So he oversaw four churches, two of which were large music programs.
Yeah.
And the school he taught at were like the highest ability youth from the whole region of Germany. They were boarding school students that were exceptional students, but also musicians. But as you pointed out, he was always fighting not only for more money for himself, but more money for his musicians, so that he could hire people to do the really hard stuff. Mm-hmm. And just some things never change in church music. He also wrote harder things for the holiday festivals because the college kids were home. And so there are very good records. Like he knew there was a great violist that was in Heidelberg studying law. and that she would be home at Christmas time.
Wow.
And you can track this. It's incredible. They have great records. If we had more time, I would love to get into a discussion of church music today. And I know we probably all go to different churches with different traditions, and some of us might have really strong opinions about community versus contemporary music today and those differences. But instead, maybe we can end with a minute or two of any other questions or thoughts and ideas about a whole bunch of crammed information about Luther and about Bach. Yes?
I was talking to David Dahl about Pacific Lutheran University's organists and the music, church music being taught there.
Yes.
They have, what did he say, 3 or 4 church music musicians and one of the best organs to teach it with in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, but he went through a short time when he was doing that. And then there's this huge group of people that went through, and now there's nobody there again. So if anybody has somebody who wants to have be a church musician, go to PLU now. You get lots of personal attention from really good teachers.
Yeah, a student to teacher ratio that almost rivals Holden Village, right? Yeah, it's definitely, it's so many churches prefer. Now the larger churches, some of us might belong to, you still might have a thriving traditional music program. But a lot of the smaller programs now either have a small contemporary band or just a pianist.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's just praise music, which is the third of the...
Yes, that's the third of our most recent, yeah. Maureen, do you have a question or thought?
Yeah, my thought was, so a lot of the stuff that you describe about Bach seems almost like for really like 21 children and a cantata every week. And I mean, I know why we don't have 21 children today, because control and the printing press, right? But why don't we have anybody, one person, or a group of people that are writing that much music? I mean, what, it makes you think that he had ghostwriters or had other ways of being so prolific, because especially if you develop a very singular style, then maybe that's what you do. But I'm curious about that, because 1 week versus 3 years is not even comparable at all.
Yeah.
And so I'm just struggling to understand how that can be so different.
A really good question. And Bach is maybe the most prolific, but certainly not the only. We can think about people like Haydn that wrote 104 symphonies in 25 years. And that is just, and even though the old joke is he wrote 104 symphonies because he wrote one symphony 104 times.
Yeah.
You know that joke? Yeah.
Yes.
But the reality of it is he still wrote 104 symphonies. And they might be similar in style, but there are 104 different symphonies. So it's hard to understand how prolific some people were then. There's certainly a handful of people today that are still living or recently were deceased that have written a ton of music. I can name 3 or 4 off the top of my head. But not to the quantities of a Bach or a Haydn.
Or the quality.
Yeah.
I think I have somewhat of an understanding, because when I create anything, it's not so that someone can see it. It's so that I can do it. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that was his thinking. Yes, someone will enjoy this. Yes, I'm getting paid for it, but in reality, really, this is what I do.
Yeah.
Did they have patrons? I mean, maybe, did they have patrons that helped support them while they did all this music?
That's good.
Bach did not, but many of the composers at the time did. Handel wrote, he was very successful at a young age, and he was brought to England by patrons and by a concert series that had a lot of wealth. And he made a lot of money when he moved there and wrote. And certainly people like Haydn worked for a patron the majority of his career. But Bach worked for the church his entire career. So everything that he did was just a paycheck like I get from Westwood Lutheran Church. You know, and he just kind of went, I guess above and beyond is an understatement.
Well, his contract called for some of that production.
It absolutely did. Yep. It absolutely did. Mm-hmm. It asked of a new cantata each week. So that's changed slightly since. Any other questions before we wrap up? And
Yeah, sometimes people say Bach is like the fifth evangelist or the fifth gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know like who said that or like where that actually came from?
Gosh. Does anyone here know?
I am sure. It comes out of a Lutheran sort of piety that is approached. I mean, there's a phrase that came up during in the 17th century. God's teachings and Luther's explanations will never disappear. You know, it's kind of like, oh, really? You know, it's over the top. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's that sort of thing.
Yeah. And Bach was known as being like a civil servant, an upstanding human being. Like, there's just one or two bad stories about him in his entire career, and they're actually quite comical. Like, he told a bassoonist once that he sounded green, which was apparently a terrible thing to call a bassoonist in 1720. And the bassoonist punched him in the mouth after rehearsal. And they got into a brawl outside a pub. But, you know, there's a few funny comments like that that are pretty well written. But otherwise, he sounded like an upstanding person and a man of strong faith.
Temper.
Yep, he definitely had a bit of a temper. Not maybe what Luther had from a,
I was going to say,
not even the same world as Luther.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was known to get frustrated with the higher ups. He was known to get frustrated with limitations of his job, just like many of us do in our jobs today. So, great. Well, I don't want to keep us too long. Feel free if you want to chat more about it.